You actually need derivatives for us to get bigger.
James Chek specializes in studying the Bitcoin economy and has made significant contributions to the field of on-chain analysis. He accurately predicted this long stretch of consolidation and has formulated new theories on how the introduction of more Bitcoin derivatives will affect the market, many of which he will share today.
What are the options going to do as it pertains to price and, more importantly, volatility moving forward?
There is no question the volatility profile will evolve and change with options. I think cycles, the idea of cycles, is probably breaking down. The 4-year may not be as clear cut as it used to be, so I'm certainly running on that assumption.
Which side of the market do you think blows up first, the longs or the shorts? Well,
you've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Was that a bull trap that we just saw last night? Are we bull trapped right now, James?
I mean, everyone, if you look at the sentiment on Twitter, right, the first daily red candle after, you know, it's the biggest monthly bull flag I've ever seen. Everyone's looking at the hourly chart being like, holy shit, it's over.
I thought we were going to 75K last night.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Like, I mean, certainly a lesson that I've learned from markets in my time is they love to coax you into, like, it's an emotional thing. And people don't realize you're trading against yourself, right? And even if you're not trading, our emotions live on the daily chart because that's what we see. That's what we feel. But at the end of the day, like, you have to look at the big picture. And I know it's a bored old trope, but zooming out is actually a legitimate thing, because if you're one of these big institutional guys, they don't care about the hourly chart. Their traders who do execution worry about the hourly chart. For most people, right, these big institutions, they're looking at the monthly and the weekly and saying, is this thing an uptrend? And I mean, it's hard to argue it's a downtrend.
No, it's funny, here in the States, at least, it's typically like a Sunday night pump fake, where it's 8 p.m. on the East Coast, Sunday night football's on, gets like halftime, the price is running, and then by the time you get to bed, it's like, looks like this is dead. But let's zoom out. I mean, I was telling you before we hit record, I've been reading your newsletter pretty consistently since the last time that we spoke, and I'll let you say, but what is the latest with CHOP consolidation? Is it over? You mentioned the monthly bull flag. What is a bull flag?
Yeah.
For those listeners who aren't well-versed in TA.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, CHOP consolidation has been my thesis more or less for the whole time. I started writing news out in mid-April, right? So we've hit the all-time high, we've pulled back a bit, and that's when I actually started writing. And I think it would have been about early May, we started writing about CHOP consolidation. And the thesis was, close your eyes for 6 months, and we'll probably be at the exact same price. I'm pretty sure when I wrote that piece, it was like 63K. Close your eyes for 6 months. Bulls and bears will get liquidated. Everyone will be excited and get blown up. And 6 months later, you'll be at the same price. And there'll be just the bodies of traders all the way to get there. And I can't even begin to tell you how many Twitter posts I've seen of traders who blew up their accounts, like lost millions in this chop. And the reason that I had this thesis is markets just can't go in a straight line, right? If you spend enough time in this space, you realize you get trends and then you get corrections and consolidations. And we basically trended up for 18 months, right? There was a pause kind of halfway through last year, but for the most part, since FTX, it's just been uninterrupted up only with very, very small drawdowns, right? Less than 20%, which Bitcoin normally does like a 30 on a regular basis. So, and even on a closing basis, we only got like 26% through this whole CHOP consolidation process. So it was really just about like recharging the gas tank, but it wasn't recharging the gas tank on like a small daily time frame. On the monthly scale, we were tired, right? You go up for 18 months, 6 months of sideways is about right. We end up getting 7 months, but you know what this has really done is just built this like foundation, this reaccumulation pattern. I mean, I've seen many people talk about it. Bitcoin has this like bear market floor, and then it goes through a bit of a recovery phase, and then there's a reaccumulation period. And 2019 was by far the closest analog to this period. But the difference with 2019, it was much more aggressive to the downside. We got really, really nasty wicks, really bad sell-offs. You know, it was down like 50, 60% if you include COVID. But this was like down 26. We had one wick on the yen carry trade to 32. But like for the most part, it's just been chopping sideways. And if you look at it on a monthly chart, it's just like red, green bars just stacked next to each other. It's beautiful.
And what do you think the institutions, I mean, you mentioned them earlier, they're looking at this zoomed out chart. And obviously we had pretty massive inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs last couple of weeks. How do you think they've been viewing this summer of chop?
Yeah, so I think we spoke about this, I think, the last time I was on, this carry trade, right? And I do believe that's still a big component of it. And there's still a lot of misunderstanding about derivatives just in general, but this whole carry trade. The idea of the carry trade is that there's already a premium in the CME futures, which means there is a long side bid. So in order to get that premium in the first place, people are just generally, you know, accumulating and buying. When they do the carry trade, they have to buy the ETF. And because Bitcoin is fixed supply, it's still taking coins off the market, right? They're not available for sale if they're locked in an ETF. And also, even if they've got a short position on the derivatives. So generally speaking, I think for the institutions, they're seeing an asset that is volatile, although a little bit less volatile, right? So that's going to allow some more institutions to come in. It's bigger in size, right? Yes, we've been chopping around for 7 months, but we've been chopping around for 7 months between like 55 and 70K, right? This is not 6K and 7K. We're talking about a whole order of magnitude bigger, and it's just chopping sideways, right? And if you think about the market cap, we have proven that we belong up here at $1 trillion, right? For the second time. The first time we attempted that in 2021, we got rejected. We tried it again. We got nastily rejected in the 2022 bear. And here we are for 7 months, barely 20% drawdown, just chopping around at a trillion and change. Now, these institutions, if they look at those big scale charts, they're just seeing an asset that has holders who aren't willing to sell, right? And that's by and large what we've seen. I mean, there's definitely been sell side. There's been kind of two different buckets of sell side that I've seen. There has been long-term holders and OG selling. This is just a real thing. And you can see it. There's like coins. This is the beautiful thing about on-chain data. I can see that coins are taking profit, meaning they were acquired at a very cheap price and now they're moving, and they were old. And you can't fabricate that, right? The blockchain just is what it is. The UTXOs are either old or they're not, and they're in profit or they're not. So we can see lots of those coins coming back into the market. And in the last like month, really towards the, as we come into August and the tail end of September, that OG, like long-term holder selling really tapered off, like markedly, almost just went to zero. And since then we've started creeping higher. There's also been a whole lot of these big buckets, right? German government, US government, Mt. Gox has distributed. Like, these are huge pools of supply that were moved, redistributed. And these big institutions, right? I mean, we saw with the German government, the market sold off in anticipation, right? The actual selling when the market traded lower before the German government sold most of their supply. As they sold like 48,000 Bitcoin, the market actually rallied through it. Who is there absorbing 48,000 Bitcoin in like a matter of one? It was like, I think it was 1 week. It has to be just big money, right? There's simply not enough hodlers up here at $1 trillion to do that. So there's money that's been patiently allowing the market to sell to it. It's not hitting the market bid. It's just saying, here's my price. You come to me, sell to me. Thank you very much.
And when you consider the macroeconomic landscape, too, you have to imagine some of these larger institutional types are doing exactly what you just described, because you look at the Fed lowered rates by 50 bips and you had the 10-year and the 30-year running higher, the yield, which is counterintuitive to what you would expect with the Fed lowering rates. You have Stan Druckenmiller coming out and putting 20% of his family office portfolio short bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds specifically, which is a big bet that is very contrarian right now. Obviously, we have the U.S. election. I think a lot of people are waiting for the results of that election in a couple of weeks before making any larger allocation decisions. But then, yeah, the tried and true alarm bells and precious metals with gold and silver running towards all-time highs as well. And so despite the fact that Bitcoin's been in this chop solidation, you do have these external macroeconomic factors at play that are signaling that there may be a shift in the liquidity profile of the world as we lower rates, and that has inflation expectations. And outside of Bitcoin, it looks like people are certainly shuffling the chairs and allocating their money with the expectation of something not going as it has been going the last few years.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And the other thing about the election, right, is it doesn't really matter so much what the result is. To take out the politics of it, it doesn't really matter what the result is. Markets can rally on bad news and sell off on good news, right? If you've been around markets long enough, you'll see this all the time. What they don't like is uncertainty. And the fact that the market, you know, it's slowly getting an idea of how this is going to play out. But once it knows the result and it knows that, you know, okay, now we can actually allocate money, there will be people and institutions who take bets early, right? Having a view on where it's going. Like for me, probably for you, I don't particularly care who gets in because I think Bitcoin's going to go up anyway because that's not really the problem. The problem is the monetary system. So, you know, my bet's already in play, but there's going to be a lot of institutions that are just waiting for the rules to be laid out and then they'll make their allocations because, you know, they've got different mandates, you know, they can't weather big drawdowns. And the other thing, and I wrote a piece on this the other day, the concept of derivatives, you actually need derivatives for us to get bigger. And in my like core view, this thesis I'm currently working to, if you look at the hodlers like shrimp and crabs, right, we're talking about people under 10 Bitcoin, their balance has been more or less flat for the last 12 months, right? They haven't really grown their stack. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I think there's kind of two big reasons for this. The first one is that $1.2 trillion, you know, it's painful. 0.1 Bitcoin used to be like two stacks away. Now it's like a multi-month venture. Like when you get there, it's an achievement, right? So at this scale, people's incomes just simply don't buy as much coin as it used to. But the other one, there's a lot of hodlers who've been around since 2013, 16, even 17, 18. They're now getting to the point where they've been stacking for 7 years. The additional stack is not making a marginal difference to their balance. So we're kind of in this like eddy current or this like estuary between the original kind of hodlers who got us here, but it's very hard to push the market up into the $2 trillion, $3 trillion mark, right? It's hard for retail to do that. You actually need the institutional capital to move higher. But at the same time, these institutions, they need derivatives, whether it be futures, mostly options, which is why this options thing is actually very, very important. Because if you want to allocate $50 billion, you need to be able to hedge that risk. And if the only way for you to hedge that risk is to short a futures contract or to sell spot, you just can't allocate the $50 billion in the first place. So we're in this like interesting handing over of the baton from retail who got this to the size we currently are, to the institutions, and they do need the derivatives. They've got the ETFs now, they've got the futures, very soon they'll have the options. Then they actually have, you know, options, the optionality to hedge their risk, which means they can now allocate serious capital. So we're in this like transition period between retail dominant to institutional dominant.
Well, yeah, let's dive into the options, because obviously the SEC approved options on the Bitcoin ETFs. I believe they started trading at the end of last week. I think Charles Schwab clients got access to the options via their broker-dealer portal. Could be wrong there, but regardless, it seems like they're coming to market. I believe it was Jeff from Bitwise wrote a long thread last week. What impact are the options going to have played? I've seen many takes on both sides. It's going to be an incredible squeeze upwards, and others saying options are here. It's similar price manipulation that we've seen with gold. In your thoughts, what are the options going to do as it pertains to price and, more importantly, volatility moving forward?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting dynamics here. So one thing I'll just note, because it's important before I forget it, I listened to this really interesting, like obscure podcast with David Dredge. And he's one of these like all-time great volatility managers. And he had this really interesting point. The guy who was interviewing him is into Bitcoin and allocates to it. And David was saying, you know, until this point, I'm a volatility guy. People ask me about Bitcoin all the time. And he goes, really, I haven't been that interested for a while, not because I don't see it as like a tail risk insurance to where the world's going. Because like, I understand all that. That makes sense. But he goes, the problem is, if you've just got retail, like you and I, we earn our salary, we allocate to Bitcoin, we put our own money on the line. We have a different, I guess, risk profile, how we behave. I'll hodl through the bear market because it's my capital. He goes, what I'm interested in is I want to see when the Goldman Sachs of the world and these big guys come in, because they bet other people's money with a bailout behind them. And he goes, that's where you get the real tail risks, right? I want to see these guys blowing up on the wrong side of the trade with options, not like retail. They're a different animal. I can't extract serious money out of them. I can extract serious money out of people who are betting other people's capital with a bailout in the background, right? So that's kind of an I thought that was a really interesting dynamic, that's kind of alluding to it can get more volatile as these big institutions come on and these derivatives creep in. Now, there is no question the volatility profile will evolve and change with options. There's a couple of ways this happens. One is there's things like volatility capture. So this is kind of what the cash and carry trade is alluding to. It's like extracting a yield. But if you imagine the market rallies and we go into another chop solidation period, you can essentially have calls above and puts below and capture the like an income stream, right? You sell a call and a put, the market trades in between it, and you're essentially collecting an income, right? At some point, one of those options will get exercised, but then you can essentially roll them. And the idea is you can generate income by selling volatility and pulling that volatility out of the market. The other side of the equation, you think about who is going to be the one who's, you know, who benefits from options. And ultimately, what are derivatives? They're a tool to transfer risk. Options, best way to think about them is an insurance contract. If you're a miner, you know you have Bitcoin income in the next month, 2 months, 3 months. I want to sell that income today, right? Collect a premium by selling a covered call or something like that. I know I'm going to have the Bitcoin, so I don't particularly care if I get exercised because I'm going to have the spot anyway, but I can collect a premium until that option gets done. So you're transferring risk from the miner's balance sheet to the speculator, right? The speculator's job is to take that risk and be right or wrong. That's basically how these derivatives markets work. And it's why options and futures contracts were invented in the first place, is to actually transfer that risk. Now, there is the element of leverage that creeps into these things. So not only can you have people, you know, speculators betting in one direction and transferring that risk from the producers, or, you know, if you're a portfolio manager, I want to insure my $50,000 Bitcoin portfolio, buy a put option, you're transferring that risk to a speculator. But what happens is that people can eventually over-lever these things. So yes, you can squeeze volatility out at certain points in time, but like anything, right, there's always going to be the flip side of the equation, which is you can get this explosive volatility where a whole bunch of people are wrong. And markets are full of periods and stuff, like they're all about people being wrong. And then you get these explosive moves in one direction. So, you know, there's a whole series of dynamics that come into it, right? If you've sold a whole lot of insurance, you now have an incentive to defend that level so you don't get exercised. And that's where they start playing in the spot market. But if you kind of envision what all of this is doing, it's bringing buyers, it's bringing sellers, and that creates depth, that creates liquidity, that allows bigger money to come in, it gets bigger money to be more comfortable with it. So all of these things are creating deeper, more liquid derivatives and spot markets, which allows bigger institutions to come in with bigger capital. And this is how you move beyond a $1.2 trillion, start moving up into the $2, $4, $5, $6, $10 trillion markets.
Who do you think blows up? Which side of the market do you think blows up first, the longs or the shorts?
Well, that's a big difference with Bitcoin, is that it actually has, typically speaking, when you look at options, downside, so put insurance is more expensive. People are willing to insure their portfolio. Bitcoin actually has, if you look, it's called the volatility smile. You're basically looking at how expensive is volatility on your left tail, sell-offs, and your right tail, which is ripping to the upside. And this is, I think Jeff Parks was talking about this. Bitcoin actually has a positive on both sides, meaning there is more volatility on both tails. The equity market, basically it just grinds higher and then has these nasty sell-offs. Bitcoin has face-ripping rallies and wild sell-offs. So it actually has a true volatility smile. And I mean, that's just vol, right? It can literally explode in both directions. In my view, if you look at the way the world's going, I mean, look at the gold chart. It's telling you what is going on. The right tail is going to get pretty wild, I think.
Sup, freaks? This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is here building the Bitcoin bank of the future. It starts with their vault product, a 2 of 3 collaborative custody vault, which allows you to hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. On top of this, they're building incredible products. They're trading products. You want to buy and sell Bitcoin, you can do it through their trading desk. If you buy Bitcoin directly into cold storage, if you don't want to sell your Bitcoin, you can borrow against your Bitcoin with their lending desk. They have an IRA product, which they recently dropped the price down to 21 cents. So if you want to roll your IRA from traditional assets into Bitcoin, Unchained makes that extremely easy. You're able to hold your own keys. Again, it's the bank of the future. Go to unchained.com. Use the code TFTC when you check out for any of their products. You'll get $50 off. Check out their concierge onboarding if you're looking to do it the right way. Unchained.com. Use the code TFTC.
And I mean,
how wild do you think it can get? Because going back, like, I think this is a good setup to the next chapter in what does a hodler look like. You explain, like, long-term OGs hodling. They have their archetype. But now as we get into a deeper market with more liquidity, getting multi-trillion dollars, deca-trillions, eventually, like, what do these new hodlers look like to you? And what type of price dynamics outside the options, the volatility introduced by options, is that introduced? Because there's one thing I'm saying at 1031 is I think this could be the cycle of Bitcoin being paired with structured credit with longer durations, which creates like a new type of long-term hodler. And when you think about the amount of liquidity, particularly focused on credit markets, that could be immense. But then you have this intra-trading as well. Not sure if I explained that well, but just trying to get into something we were discussing earlier, which is the piece you wrote a couple of weeks ago, was zooming out and looking at the hodler archetypes that exist and potentially will come into existence as we transition to the next chapter.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of dynamics here, right? Like, if you think about, and you've probably seen this in your YouTube stats and all that, who is the average Bitcoiner, right? The bulk of them, millennials. They are millennials, right? That's the dominant majority of people who are watching Bitcoin content. Like, from every single metric I've ever seen in terms of, like, the social demographic, millennials, giant bulge. There's some people who are younger, some people who are older, most millennials. Whereabouts are they in their journey, right? If you've been in Bitcoin for a number of years, you've probably been, you know, you've got a decent enough stack. And this cycle, I mean, I do have a kind of general concept. And again, I think cycles, the idea of cycles is probably breaking down. The 4-year may not be as clear cut as it used to be. So I'm certainly running on that assumption. But let's just, if we talk about the cycle, the next 10 years, right? 5 years, 6 years, whatever that kind of general period is. I think this is probably going to be the cycle where a lot of those millennials, right? They're doing two things. One, they're probably going to have a nest egg. They go, holy shit. Well, they actually look at the number and they go, it's actually pretty big, right? I kind of did it, right? Good job. But then they're also moving into a period of their life where they're starting families, buying homes. You know, my favorite saying for Bitcoin is, like, what is Bitcoin? And for me, it's my savings. What do you use your savings for? Whatever the fuck you want. And, you know, for me, it's a house, right? At some point, I'm saving for a house. If I look at the Australian housing market is wild, right? It's gone up 40, 50% since 2020, but it's down. I think last I checked in December, actually, so it's actually been better than this, it was down 75% in Bitcoin terms. So I can buy 4 times more house than I could in 2020, whereas the average person is down 50% and on their salary. So where are those millennials going to be? They're probably going to be either using their Bitcoin, just, you know, sell a bit of it to actually pay for these things. I mean, you'll never pry all the Bitcoin out of Bitcoiners' hands, right? You might get 5, 10%, but for the most part, they're going to just sit tight. So I think there's going to be this, like, transferring of the baton where the market will have to finance Bitcoiners, you know, progressing in their life, and then they'll just hodl the rest. But I also think you're right in terms of that, like, structured product. That feels like the next real evolution, whether it's Bitcoin getting added to, like, a global index, because it is really a bit of a global index. It is one of those diversified assets where you can put it into, like, you know, 5%, 3%. I think we saw Fidelity recommending, like, up to 5% for their clients. There's all these, like, just put a little bit in here, right? Go from zero to something. And that dynamic, just tucking it into that ETF, putting it into that global fund, putting it into that pension fund, just little bits here and there, it's very hard to get your head around the size of the numbers in the traditional finance world. I think one of the most instructive things for me that's happened in the last 12 months was Wisconsin, that the pension fund added 0.1%. This is $180 million. And that's like, they don't care because it's such a small component, but they expect to get to 2%. And you just start thinking about, like, how many pension funds and, you know, global asset allocators have 0.1% that is hundreds of millions of dollars. It's just enormous capital, right? So these are some of those dynamics I think is probably going to play out. I think the structured product is interesting. It's like you've got a debt instrument and then you're attaching, like, a Bitcoin kicker to it. We'll probably start to see things like that. We'll also see ETFs that are just, like, you know, covered call strategies, so people can actually earn an income off Bitcoin's volatility, which, again, yes, they're extracting volatility over here, but what they're also doing is adding depth to both the options market and to the spot market in order to achieve that. So all of these things just allow bigger capital to put more money. It's how this market starts to evolve.
Yeah. And we were talking about it before we hit record too, is the idea of MicroStrategy copycats. Because when you think about these different pools of capital, there's different type of hodlers. That's why I'm partial towards like structured credit, like dual collateralizing a commercial real estate project with the real estate asset and Bitcoin over the life of a 10, 15 year loan. That Bitcoin's locked up in that loan for 10, 15 years. But obviously Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy have proven to be very successful in their speculative attack of fiat capital markets to accumulate as much Bitcoin and have their stock price benefit as a result of that. And it seems like there are many others that are looking at what they're doing and saying, we should be doing this too. But this is a new type of buyer where the Bitcoin isn't locked up in the way it would be in a structured credit product. You can have much weaker hands at this level.
Oh, yes. No, I really enjoyed your chat with Dylan the other week, because he's got a lot more insight into the mechanics of this. I think that for me, when I look at MicroStrategy, it's breathtaking what he's doing. Just incredible the way that he's playing the capital markets. It really is a sight to behold. We haven't seen all that many companies kind of click on to doing this. And personally, I think that's actually good. I don't particularly want to see too many companies doing this for one reason. They just won't have the stones that Michael Saylor has in that bear market, which will come. And the closest analog that I can think of is actually miners. So miners have forever been pro-cyclical. And that means that they hodl too much in the bull, which squeezes supply and gives us juice to the upside. But then they hodl way too long and they end up selling usually near the arse end of the bear. So you've got this, like, you know, they buy it and hold it at the best times, and they sell all of it at the worst times. And I can only imagine if we start getting these, like the day that GameStop buys Bitcoin to like save itself, that's like the reddest of flag for me, just shooting up in the air going, okay, we're getting pretty close to euphoria at this point. So, you know, there'll be all these dynamics, but I kind of don't want to see too many companies do it. A little, like putting some on the balance sheet, yes. But at the same time, I think there's just that one component. You can kind of see it, right? All these zombie companies saying, oh, Bitcoin's my get out of jail free card. And it's like, nah, you're going straight to jail.
This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff.
We've been talking about this a lot at 1031 to like, what does the evolution of this strategy look like? And I certainly think there will be the zombie company. We need to get ourselves out of the situation where we're going nowhere, no prospects for growth, and use the attack on the capital markets to develop a Bitcoin strategy to get ourselves out of this hole. But I think for it to be successful in the long run, it's going to have to be done via companies that have strong cash flowing businesses under them, where they can leverage this MicroStrategy strategy to an extent, but at the end of the day, they have enough cash flow and they're actually producing productivity and growth throughout the economy that allows them to service that debt if they ever get in a pickle. Like if it's just zombie companies with no cash flow, I think that is not in the best interest of the Bitcoin price in the long run.
Agree. But I think the one thing that, and certainly what I've learned the most by watching Michael Saylor, and it, you know, it's funny because it seems really obvious in hindsight, but the role of volatility, right? Volatility is always a thing people say, oh, Bitcoin's too volatile. But if you think about it, it's like, well, if an asset's not volatile, you're not going to go from zero to 1.2 trillion. You're not going to go from 1.2 trillion to 10 trillion, right? Without volatility, you need volatility to move. So Michael Saylor's really injected volatility. You can see it in his stock price. He went sideways for like 30 years, and now it's just the most, it's ripping to the upside. You got 3x levered ETFs on it. Like it's chaos. But at the same time, he's added, I mean, I actually don't know what the multiple is, but he's, you know, 10, 20, I think like 1,000x, whatever it is, in terms of how he's grown that stock price, it's unbelievable. So injecting that volatility back into markets, this is the thing I've always found so fascinating about like commodities versus equities. Equities just don't have volatility, right? Certainly in the last decade and a half, they just grind sideways. They get the occasional vol spike to the downside. Someone steps in, bails it out, up it goes again. So it's this like really artificial. Look at the world around us. It's volatile as anything, right? The shit happening all over the place. Bitcoin's volatility reflects the world, in my view. It's like a more normal and organic. I understand it, right? Things happen on a Sunday night. You get some kind of headline about conflict or whatever it is. Bitcoin trades up, down, left, right. I find it so funny that all these TradFi guys who just, they hate Bitcoin. But then the moment that something happens on a Sunday, they post the Bitcoin chart because it's like a lens into what's going to happen on Monday morning. So it is becoming that global index. But at the same time, there's like this volatility coming back, right? Making volatility a part of market cycles again. And volatility allows people to capture yield. It allows people to trade things, allows growth to, you know, assets can't go up in a serious manner and reprice to the upside and the downside, but to the upside without volatility. And I think volatility is good. People should actually get more used to volatility. And I got this long-term thesis that Bitcoiners have dealt with volatility. We've seen our net worth go up and down, you know, 300% to the upside, down 80%, four or five times in like a decade. You're hardened up. You've got this like hardened up nature to you that once you get into a decision-making capacity and the world's volatile around you, you can keep a cool, calm head and actually make these decisions, right? It's that low time preference thinking. So I think there's so many benefits to the world being a little bit more volatile. And in a way, Bitcoin and MicroStrategy is kind of injecting that back in as a good thing, right? It's taking away the negative connotation of vol.
Yeah, it's forcing people not to be complacent.
100%.
You can't just ride the liquidity spigot anymore, which is a good thing. And I mean, but getting back to this, like volatility re-entering the Bitcoin market, particularly after this 6+ months of chop solidation. I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning. We've got a monthly bull flag. What does that mean, like moving forward? Like how volatile, how quickly, if at all, do we get from here on out? Because obviously it's October.
October.
Are we getting October this year?
Yeah, I love that, right? The moment that October was the headlines, we sold off. I can't remember what the price was. But we sold off, you know, 10, 12% almost immediately. So when we talk about a bull flag, this is a technical, and again, I don't do a great deal of technical analysis, but I understand the general concepts. A good way to think about markets, they do adhere to the laws of physics. You cannot just go up in a straight line. You must have corrections and consolidations along the way. And what that does is people always buy too high and then they sell low. And who are they selling to? People with a higher conviction who are waiting for a better price. Now, when you get just markets ripping to the upside, the pullbacks are smaller and smaller. It doesn't actually allow people to get in. People start to FOMO and you get a real explosive top. And really, the March ETF high was one of those explosive tops. People are going, holy shit, we're going to 100K. I got to buy this thing right now. And of course, that was the maximum period of euphoria. You then get this process of redistribution. Top buyers, they buy high, they sell low. Long-term holders, they take a bit of profit and take some chips off the table because they're seeing the asset at a bigger size. They now have the ETFs to actually sell to, right? There's a big bid on the spot side. But overall, you've got this kind of downward trending channel. And the way I would describe the last 6 months is extremely structured. Really, just trading within a really, really well-defined channel, like a top bound and a lower bound, just bouncing between them as it ranged down. But there's a general concept that markets that are trading lower, right? Assuming the asset isn't complete dog shit, right? So let's just talk about Bitcoin here. When an asset is trading lower, eventually it will break back to the upside. right? Downtrends break to the upside eventually. And exactly the same, uptrends will break to the downside eventually, because nothing can keep going up in a straight line. Nothing can keep going down in a straight line in the world of Bitcoin, right? Shitcoins will go to zero. If we're talking, so from that perspective, it's amazing to me to see all of these people saying, oh, but it's like we were on bear market territory. People were saying, oh, this thing's, you know, it's a downtrend for 7 months. That's so bearish. Yes, the maximum drawdown was 26%. If you go back to any previous bull cycle, that's like the smallest drawdown. So you've got 7 months of, yes, trending lower, but downtrends break to the upside eventually. So when we talk about a bull flag, if you look at the monthly price chart, it looks like a flagpole where the market's ripped into March, and then it's just chopped downwards and sideways for 6 months. And what that's doing, it's allowing the market to redistribute coins from people who don't know what they own to people who do know what they own. Now, of course, sometimes those things can break down. You actually get some kind of a top formation. But usually speaking, if you go back to 2021, those rounded tops, they were ascending patterns, right? The price was going higher, but with less momentum. That's actually a bearish sign because you've got less buyers. The market can't keep going higher. We actually had declining sell side during those tops. So you've got less sellers. Price is kind of going higher, but it was really telling you we were running out of steam. Whereas here, you've got this nicely descending pattern. Descending patterns break to the upside eventually. And that's what I mean by a bull flag. It literally looks like a flagpole and then a flag on a monthly basis. If you zoom into the hourly chart, it looks like chaos. It looks like the nastiest bear market you've ever seen. But zooming out, that's all within the context of allowing the monthly chart to just take a breather, have a rest, right? Recharge, and then away you go again.
And it's funny how psychology leaks into this, the 7 months of chop, trending lower. And a lot of people have checked out, and particularly if you're not already in Bitcoin. And I tweeted about this the other week, but it's very reminiscent right now. And it will always be reminiscent because the way Bitcoin halving cycles work and cycles work just more generally, it's like for some reason there's always an election year during a halving. Things typically pop off in the fall, but comparing all of the cycles that I've lived through, it'll be 2013, 2014, through to 2017, and obviously forward to today, it feels a lot like the fall of 2016 now. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it. Bitcoin started floating up, and float up somewhat slowly from like 600 to 1100 between October to March, I believe. And then things really got popping in like June, July, obviously into the blow off top in the end of that year. But just remembering, and I actually have like journal notes from this time that I can go back and read, and read some of them the other day. And I remember being like, Bitcoin's going up, nobody's paying attention. Yes. It sort of feels like that right now, where if you look at Google Trend search data, like Bitcoin search volumes at all time lows, and yet people that have been paying attention for as long as we have are going like, oh, I remember this feeling. I remember what this environment was like and what happened after.
Yep, 100%. So I wasn't around in 2016. I bought the 2017 top. So that was me up there. But from from my studies and just kind of understanding how this market works, 2016 is very close analog. So, and I think a lot of 2016 is actually because it's a spot-driven market, right? 2016, there was no derivatives. So very, very spot-driven. And yes, derivatives and futures and all that are at all-time high in terms of open interest. However, we still have a very spot-dominated market. In fact, I would say that the current market is much more spot-dominated than it was in 2021. 2021, it was all about the perpetual swap. Everything was about futures. And the only spot element there was that GBTC bid pulling in like 660,000 Bitcoin in 4 months, right? That was the spot bid. But for the most part, it was just leverage. This cycle, most of the leverage is also paired with a spot buy, right? And I did a chart the other day where I was looking at the ETF inflows. We've seen like 2 billion in the last couple of days. That 2 billion is paired with about 1.8 billion coming into the CME futures. So that to me looks like a lot of buy spot, sell future, right? But remember, the reason the future has a premium is because people are long. So generally speaking, there's a long bias to these things. The other period that's very similar is 2019. although much more bearish, right? And we also had a, you know, there's a lot of sell side going on. There was the Plus Token Ponzi absorbed like 2% of the supply, and then the CCP sold those coins, and we didn't find out until we were down like 8K, and you know, it was chaos back then. And then we had March 2020. But really 2016, 2019, by far the closest periods. There's a couple of similarities to that, like mid-2021, although that mid-2021 sell-off, right? I remember the Chinese mining ban. That was a really, really important, and I need to actually write a piece on this. The Chinese mining ban, in my view, wasn't what started that bear market. Usually markets, they need a catalyst. When there's already something baked in the cake, it just needs a catalyst to trigger it. The GBTC going from a premium to a discount was what really happened. Suddenly you've got a 660,000 bid that just disappeared. The market started curling over, leverage was really high, everyone was betting on 100,000. And then the Chinese mining ban was just the match that got flicked in, and then away we went. And that sell-off was like 50% down. That broke the bull sentiment. And in a piece I did yesterday, how do you determine when a bear has really kicked in? Because a lot of people are talking about this chop solidation saying it's a bear market. And my whole thesis really for the last 6 months has been trying to distinguish, is this a bear or is it a correction? How do we actually distinguish those two? And that mid-2021 point is actually a really good reference point. Both in mid-21 and in this chop solidation, we had 30% of all Bitcoin was underwater, right? So on a just, is the coin above or below its cost basis? 30% of all coins at the worst point were below their cost basis. So then the other one is, how bad is it? Because if you bought a coin and you're down 5%, that's another day in Bitcoin. If you buy a coin, you're down 50%. That destroys your sentiment. You feel bloody awful after it, and you start making decisions going, oh, I'll take the next exit liquidity pump. So then I start looking at unrealized losses. And in 2021, it was massive. It was like 20% of the Bitcoin market cap was just unrealized loss. Really nasty stuff. Bear market starting. In this chop solidation, the peak, the high watermark on the yen carry trade was about 7%. So you're comparing 20% underwater versus 7%. Very typically in a bull market correction, so all through 2017, 5%, 7%, 6%, very typical. So we never got the scale of the damage, right? It just wasn't bad enough. Yes, 30% of coins are underwater, but they're underwater by 5% or 4% or 3%. And HODLers can handle that. So in many ways, this chop solidation looks a lot more like a bull market correction than it does to some kind of really nasty bear market starting, bull sentiment shattering event. We just didn't get that. And that's been a real grounding anchor for me, is just because a coin is underwater, the next question is by how much?
Yeah. That's really good info to have. And that's like, again, going back to, that's why I love talking to you, because you come equipped with data that allows people to detach themselves from the emotions that come from these cycles. And I mean, just speaking for myself, like having been through many of these cycles, the emotions still get to you.
Oh, yes.
You're still like, oh, you're up on a Sunday night, like, oh, we're going to 75. And then it's like, ah, take a step back, zoom out. But with all that in mind, like, is there anything in your mind that could like prevent the bull from materializing? Just thinking of, again, going back to the macroeconomic landscape, it does look like there's some systemic weakness, despite what many economists would lead you to believe. Again, looking at the treasury markets, and I've been doing a lot of sleuthing on people covering banks, particularly Bank of America. You just had Warren Buffett sell off a huge chunk of Bank of America, which he's held as one of his largest positions for decades. And it seems like some of the savvier institutional types are shuffling the chairs on the tight, or not shuffling the chairs, but they're positioning themselves expecting some economic turmoil moving forward. Like, do you think some major economic crisis could throw a wrench in any potential bull market that may lie ahead for Bitcoin? Or do you think this is potentially a cycle where it becomes a true safe haven and people seek safety in Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think first things first, we're going back to the topic we had before, it's going to be volatile. Right? Things are going to happen, because if there was probably about 6 months ago, maybe 8 months ago, I remember I took a screenshot of my podcast feed, right? All the new episodes that have come in, and it was just top to bottom, markets going to zero, deflation is coming, watch out for the bust, boom, boom. Just every single thing was like, I'm the most giga bearish I've ever been. And of course, the market went up despite all of that, right? So you've got all these experts saying, oh no, it's the end of the world, blah, blah, blah. And now we're seeing this kind of reflation starting to kick in, right? People are starting to believe that, hang on a second, markets are at all-time high, Fed's cutting cycle, inflation actually might come back. Like, you've got all these like interesting dynamics. You know, arguably, the Fed should be raising rates, not cutting rates at this point in time. So then you've got to look into all those kind of, you know, why? Is it political? Is it, you know, what is it, because the government's just paying too much in interest? I think the thing to really recognize is the world is in a very, very volatile place. And very few, I would argue probably no traders have ever experienced this kind of market before, right? You hear the Druckenmillers of the world and these guys, they'll say, no one in the world has done this before, right? No one has dealt with this. So in that regard, there could be things that happen on a Sunday night and Bitcoin is the only way for them to express their view. I would also say that many of these institutions, they simply haven't done the compute cycles that you and I have. I know why I hold Bitcoin. It's because after whatever this volatile ride is, I want to own it at the end of that journey. Because, and I did a study a couple of weeks back where I was basically looking at, in this chop solidation range, how many days out of Bitcoin's life does it go up 1%, down 1%, or nowhere? And over a third of all days, Bitcoin goes absolutely nowhere, right? Less than 1% move in either direction. So if you think about, if you're a long side trader, right? You put on a long position, there's a 33% chance you're going to go nowhere, which means you'll be wrong. If it goes down, there's the other 33%. So you've only got a 1 in 3 chance of being correct on any single day. This is why day traders get blown up all the time, because the odds are actually, you know, 1 to 3. But if you look at that on a big picture view, on like a quarterly basis, it's massively skewed to the upside, right? These traders, you actually do, you get these like single quarters where it's plus 100%, and then it goes sideways. So Bitcoin does nothing most of the time and then explodes to the upside and the downside sometimes. So many of these firms are not ready to trade this kind of stuff. They've never seen an asset that trades this way. And then you've got the world going through all inflation, deflation, sovereign debt crisis, conflict, elections that are just complete circuses. Like, pick your poison. There's so many things that can create the swings in the upside and the downside. But over the macro trend, Bitcoin is one of these assets you will perform better as just a buy and hold. Because if you're there for those explosive quarters where it just all happens and Bitcoin reprices, that's what you need to be there for. And, you know, how many people, when you're trying to convince people about Bitcoin, right? They're like, oh, don't worry, I'll just buy it when it's the time. It's like, no, you have to position yourself long in advance and then just wait, right? The hardest thing in Bitcoin is just doing absolutely nothing and just waiting. But eventually you get these tail events. So I think we will get volatile swings in every direction. It's why these options are going to be, in my view, the killer product for Wall Street. Finally, they have an asset that is truly volatile that they can trade options on. There's going to be capture strategies, the whole lot. But those swings on both directions is really where those, this is what David Dredge talks about. I don't care about the expected return. I don't care about the, you know, the bell curve in the middle. You make your money on the left and the right tails. That's where the money is actually made. And from his perspective, it's like, and it's even better when the people who are blowing up on that left and right side have bet other people's money with a bailout behind them, because that's the big money. That's where you pull the huge returns out of.
Yeah. So you're saying it's going to get interesting.
Absolutely. And yeah. And it's going to be really easy to get shaken out. And, you know, I did a piece recently where I was talking about, we live on the daily chart. Our emotion, like we live day to day, we check the Bitcoin price. Our emotions live on the daily chart, but your decisions should live on the weekly and the monthly chart, right? So just extract the emotions from the decisions, put your decisions on the bigger time frame. Let your, you know, the emotions will always get to you. It's a constant battle. You have to constantly fight yourself from FOMO and fear, right? You're always going to be fearful when it's trading lower. Even the Mt. Gox guys, I love this kind of analog. These Mt. Gox guys bought their coins in the hundreds of dollar range, right? For peanuts. They got their coins back at about 68K. When the market sold off to 53, where do you think their emotional state was? They're not looking at their $200 price point. Oh, I'm only down at, you know, I'm only up 45,000% now. It's like, no, they feel like they've got their coins at 68 and now they're down. That's how they emotionally feel. And that's a real, like, in terms of how you think about these markets, understanding where your emotions live versus what your decision should be is just such an important skill for a hodler to learn, because otherwise you will get caught up on the Twitter narrative. You'll go looking for all the reasons why it's selling off. It's almost never the reason. The narrative on Twitter is almost always just an excuse people wrap around something that was already forming months in advance, right? So people are like, oh, look, ETF flows. That's why we're going higher. It's like, no, we're going higher because hodlers refused to sell and a bunch of people bought the lows for 7 months. That's why we're going higher. It's got nothing to do with the ETFs. The ETF is just that like final kindling that gets the ball moving.
Yeah. Yeah, no, now you got me thinking, like, the volatility that I can't imagine. I'm just thinking, is the extent and the gravity of the Mt. Gox blow up just like an appetizer for what one of these large option trader funds blowing up is going to look like?
Absolutely. And look, I mean,
and does that,
not that it's a risk that I really factor in, but I see a lot of people saying, oh, Coinbase doesn't have the coins for these ETFs. Guys, that's not the risk you should be worried about. The risk is that they have way too many. Coinbase has so many coins, it's unbelievable. The biggest risk is that something actually goes on there. Like, to me, the most catastrophic risk that I think can happen to Bitcoin right now is that something goes wrong with Coinbase custody. That is the gorilla in the room that no one wants to talk about. So don't worry about them not having the coins. Worry about how many they actually already have. That's the real risk.
And if you're listening and you have your coins on Coinbase, do your part to distribute that a concentration risk away from them. What was I just going to say? Give me a second here. We're talking institutions, volatility, Mt. Gox. Something else I was going to bring up. Slipped my mind, though. It'll come to me. Lost it. Completely lost it. First time.
Sorry, I think I cut in there, and that's the lose your thought.
No, it's just thinking about like broader trends of where we're going, and particularly if that's what I was going to bring up, like the volatility, like the Weimar gold chart is what comes up a lot, is the volatility that happened during that period, particularly with the gold price, and that seems like we could be heading into that territory with Bitcoin, with the options and the macroeconomic sovereign debt crisis backdrop.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually like spot on, absolutely spot on. And I think that is the framework that most people should go into this thinking, is on the macro scale, it's going to look like a parabola that's unstoppable. On the monthly scale, right, when you start looking at what's going on week to week, month to month, there'll be drawdowns, there'll be swings higher, there'll be chaos, right, on that like rate of change basis, it's all over the place. But on the macro scale, right, they're not paying off this debt anytime soon. It's not going to happen. So, you know, they have to print the money. This is the do not, you can't stop the train. It's going to happen.
Yeah. And we have so much circumstantial evidence that the central banks even believe this, with the papers that were recently written by the European Central Bank and the Minneapolis Fed branch, which basically, I mean, the ECB tried to basically say that Bitcoin has failed as a payment system. It's a zero-sum game. The hodlers are going to get extremely wealthy. And if you don't get in and you're not, if you don't have Bitcoin, it's going to be at the detriment to you.
Bullish.
And then the Minneapolis Fed essentially coming out being like, we recognize that we're going to have to keep printing insane amounts of debt moving forward. We should probably make Bitcoin illegal for individuals to hold and just try to accumulate as much as possible and issue debt into ad infinitum. So that we can keep doing this. And like they're even beginning to admit it, though they're trying to paint Bitcoin as the big boogeyman. That was astonishing over the last week, was to say, oh, you have the ECB and now the Fed basically feeling compelled to respond to Bitcoin's success and paint it as a boogeyman.
It's funny, isn't it? Like it is almost the best thing they could do, because they're basically saying like, don't look at this. It's the perfect Streisand effect. Don't look at this thing. Right. If Bitcoin was irrelevant, there wouldn't be any papers written on it. But the fact that it is relevant and it is growing and it is seeing this uptick, right? It's no surprise that they're writing this as the market's starting to push higher again. If the market was trading lower, they wouldn't be writing this stuff. I did find it very interesting when you see like the ECB. And again, I don't know how they end up, you know, who has to review these things and what the process is for writing a piece like that. But did nobody just say, you just explained how assets work? Like, yes, when they go up, the people who bought them earlier get wealthier. That's the whole point. And what they're missing, and I mean, they obviously understand it. What they're not talking about is the fact that, well, really, it's just you destroying the denominator, right? What you're doing is saying that everybody has to hold this paper while we print it. And it's, again, they need people to hold the paper. This is the other thing, right? The system needs bag holders. This is why they regulate funds into having to own X amount of treasuries. They need someone to hold the paper as they do the debasement, right? And the more people that opt out into gold, silver, Bitcoin, whatever it is, assets, stocks, the more people who opt out, the fewer bag holders exist for the paper. So, you know, this is the game that they have to play. But I was very impressed. I'm like, surely someone with some seniority in the ECB read this paper and goes, God, we look like idiots. We can't publish this. Like, it's got to go. It's got to go out. So, you know, directions from above.
Well, and that, I mean, do you think they'll have any success? I mean, the ECB, both the ECB and the Fed papers almost explicitly called for laws against holding Bitcoin. And that's, I actually had a conversation earlier on another show I was on. It's just like curious battle testing this off of Bitcoiners. Like, do you think socially they'll be able to successfully demonize Bitcoin hodlers and the asset itself? And
it's an interesting question.
Convince.
Because, like, if I think about, like, at a retail level, right? If I think about people that in my world that aren't into Bitcoin, they wouldn't know what the letters ECB stands for. They wouldn't understand what that even is. So the vast majority of I don't think this is targeted at retail. This is targeted at the institutional guys who are starting to think about this. It's more or less, you know, if you think about what's the number one thing when you hear institutions, wind back the clock 2 years. What's the biggest thing that most institutional guys and TradFi guys would say? There's the volatility, which is fine. But the other one is they're going to make it illegal. That was always the big risk vector. They're like, if it was ever going to get successful, they'll make it illegal. To me, what are they doing this for? It's to remind those guys, you watch out, we're going to make it illegal. And they're like, oh, I can't touch it yet. They're trying to keep those guys off. Because who's reading an ECB paper? It's Bitcoiners and TradFi guys like this, right? Bitcoiners, gold bugs, and TradFi guys who want to be told, don't buy this thing. And when I left my engineering job, I sent out an email, and it was basically like, you know, I'm leaving engineering to go and work on this Bitcoin thing. I know many of you probably won't understand this decision. It doesn't, you know, you probably haven't even heard of Bitcoin. Here's a couple, I think did like 10 points where here's what the narrative is. Here's what's really going on. Energy, you know, human rights, blah, blah, all these things. And my last point was, think about the incentives of the media and put the ECB in this, right? Think about the incentives of the media. Would you rather, considering you don't own any Bitcoin and it's gone on this tremendous run, right? It would have been, I can't remember where it was trading at that point in time, 2021, probably close to now, 50K or something like that. Would you click an article that's telling you, you kind of missed a really important thing? You know, you kind of fucked up there. Would you read that? Or would you rather read something that goes, no, you were right to have missed it. It's a scam. It's used for all these nasty things. Don't touch it. They're going to ban it. Don't worry. We are going to ban it. Of course, they're going to click the thing that confirmation bias tells me I made the right decision for ignoring it this whole time. That's the incentive of this system. They want people who already have this predisposition that the government's going to ban it to be reminded by the government, we're going to ban it. Don't you buy it, right? That's that to me. That's what they're doing it for.
That's a great take. And I wonder if, again, going back to like, can it be successful? Because obviously we've mentioned bailouts. The target audience of these papers are institutions who historically have been bailed out, particularly this century. Are they having, like, is the marginal benefit of each subsequent bailout enough to convince them? Or that yeah, you're going to ban it and we should stay away from this? Or if, do you think putting your institutional investor cap on, they're looking at the problem, approaching $36 trillion in debt here in the United States, macroeconomic, geopolitical risk going parabolic. Do they have the intestinal fortitude to basically look the Fed, the ECB, any central bank in the eyes and say, no, I'm calling bullshit. Like, it's obvious that you're going to continue down this path that makes my job way harder and my purchasing power way less over time. And we're going to go, because the reason I'm getting at this is I do think we're at a pivotal point in Bitcoin's history where we probably need, despite what any like Cypherpunk may think, we need like institutional social support of this asset to really ensure that we can reap the benefits of the Bitcoin that we've accumulated up until this point.
Yeah, I mean, I do, and as much as it goes against that Cypherpunk ethos, and you know, in many ways, how many other $1.2 trillion assets exist out there that are just retail holders? There's none. It's like, there's none. They eventually, and this is what I try to write in my derivatives piece, right? It's kind of just a sobering thing. It's like, look, you can't swim against the tide. You will drown. That's just how these things work, right? So you can't change the direction of these things. An asset that gets of an appreciable size will eventually develop a derivatives market. And without a derivatives market, an asset is capped in how much it can actually grow. This is just truth. Why? Because in order to get to a $10 trillion market cap, you need the guy with a $50 billion position to be able to hedge $40 billion of it in a liquid options market. If he can't do that, he can't allocate the $50 billion in the first place. So that the only way he can hedge that is by selling it, right? Which means why you don't get to that higher level. So that derivatives component is really important from that perspective, right? You actually do need people to be able to hedge their risk. Now, on the treasury side of the equation, and just like TradFi in general, I mentioned before that everyone's talking about deflation and, you know, we're going into a nasty bear market and stocks are going to go to zero. And, you know, some of these predictions were insane, but there was, you know, what, 2 months ago, everyone was talking about recession, 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 right? That was the doom and narrative, is all about recession. And what do people do? They pile into bonds. Because historically speaking, when you get a deflation or a recessionary period, bonds are the correct trade. Doesn't the systems at power, if they need people to hold this shitty paper, don't they need to convince them that there's a bear market coming and that you should probably buy these bonds, right? They're salesmen. They need these institutions who are conditioned for years and years and years that down means bonds. Anything goes down, buy bonds. Volatility goes up means the market's selling off, I should buy bonds. This is how the most investors have been conditioned. And it will take a long time for that conditioning to be worked off. And, you know, again, I haven't been in markets long enough to really say this convincingly, but generally speaking, I think the rules changed after COVID. I think that's probably becoming a more consensus view that the rules probably changed. We don't really have the same system because a lot of these things just flipped over, whether you call it fiscal dominance or the return of inflation or whatever it is. There was just like a switch that flipped. The old rules are no longer as relevant, but everyone's going to keep operating under the rules they've trained on for their whole life, right? Some of these guys have been in markets for 40 years. In fact, maybe some of the more senior veteran guys who've been there for that 40-year, 50-year period, they know the rules have flipped because they can see the difference, right? They're that experienced that they can see the difference. Most people have only ever seen, in a deflation, buy bonds. So the systems at power, they want people to believe that it's going to go lower. They want people to believe that, you know, we're going to hike rates until the market falls over. It's like they need people to buy the bonds. And if you think about what happened in the last 2 years, they essentially took away, you talk about the unrealized losses on the banks, they basically forced them to hold those bonds because they destroyed their purchasing power. They now have to hold them for the 10 years to maturity. Thank you very much, Mr. Bagholder. You're going to hang on to those bonds because you can't sell them, right? This is like, it's so clever how they've done it. But at the end of the day, someone has to hold the paper. They have to convince people to buy the paper. And it's going to take such a long time for the market to start working out that maybe those rules don't work. And really the gold chart, in my view, is really the story of right now, because it is telling you that the rules have changed. Gold doesn't run. And actually, here's a good exercise. I pulled out the gold chart the other day. I was just flipping through my trading view. And I've got the gold chart, like the full scale monthly chart or monthly or weekly for the full history. And initially I was like, God, that's a weird looking Bitcoin chart. Holy shit, it's not Bitcoin. It's actually the gold chart. And if you look at through the whole 80s, yes, it took 20 years to do it, but it looks exactly the same as the 2018-19 bear market. Identical. Right? You've got this big, long descending triangle, breaks down. Gold is just a slower version of Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin's just fast speed running the whole gold experience.
Yeah. And what's gold at right now? Like 2700,
2800? 27, yeah.
Yeah. How high do you think? I mean, you think I can get to like 10,000 this run up? Like, well, that's the big the big elephant in the room is sovereign debt. I mean, I completely agree. COVID completely changed the game. It's like you cannot control, or excuse me, you cannot trust the central planners anymore. Mm. Not that I was trusting them before, but I think it's become well apparent. And as you were describing that, that it's going to take time. And COVID was a marked change in sentiment. It actually reminded me of when I worked at a managed futures fund, and we indexed commodity trading advisors. And this was right around the time of, like, right after QE1, Operation Twist, and QE2 is when I was working at this fund. And you saying that reminded me of conversations I would have with CIOs at these CTAs where they hadn't lived in a world with bailouts to the extent of 2008. And so this was like 2011, 2012, and they were still reorienting themselves and their strategies to a world of which you had ZIRP and mm-hmm. infinite QE, and they underperformed massively because they still believed that they were living in an environment that existed pre-2008. And I think it took them a while to actually adjust.
Absolutely. The rules change, and it just takes these guys time because you've been conditioned for years to trade in a particular environment. On your question with gold, I actually really liked Luke Groman had a take recently, and I hadn't really thought about it from this perspective. I kind of clicked a little bit, but this idea that gold doesn't have any other purpose, as much as Peter Schiff will disagree, if you price gold based on its dental usage, you don't want to hold gold, right? It's not a very high price if you're just pricing based on gold fillings. So really, gold is like primarily monetary premium. That's really its use case, right? It's monetary premium. Bitcoin, its only use case is monetary premium, right? Because that's all it is. Literally, you can't use it for anything aside from storing and moving value. That's its only job. And this idea that, like, if you go back to the 70s, you had these problems where the oil price would rise. And when the oil price, and you kind of put oil and the dollar in the same bucket here, when oil and the dollar rise, it creates stress globally, right? Because energy is your primary input. If your energy becomes more expensive, it's harder. Your debt is US dollar denominated. If the thing you need to buy, the dollar, to pay off your debt gets more expensive, both of those things create stress. So the system really can't have the release valve be oil because it has a utility purpose. We actually need it for the economy to work. So how do you reflate and actually get capital, as the ECB would say? How do you impoverish everybody else in order to make the system healthy again? You need an asset that if it goes up, it's not going to blow up the system. So it can't be the dollar. It can't really be oil. It can't be bonds because we're kind of very close to the zero bound, right? 5% is kind of the long-term average of bonds. You're probably not going to go below zero. So you can't really inflate bonds in terms of their price. So what asset do you have left to inflate and kind of the most harmlessly recapitalize the system? There's only two candidates. There's Bitcoin and gold. They're the only two assets that if you were to inflate it and give wealth effects to a bunch of investors, right? Let's just imagine for a second that gold went to $10,000 or $20,000 an ounce. Think about all the gold holders out there, right? Yes, a lot of them are central banks. A lot of them are people with just gold in their safe, people with ETFs. What are they going to, like, gold's eventually going to go into a bear market. They can take that capital and buy other stuff. Right? They can buy bank stocks, they can buy equities, they can do whatever they need to do to push that money back in and recapitalize the system. Luke Groman talks about the Fed's got this operating manual where if they just revalue the price of gold, they can suddenly deposit trillions of, I think it's $4,000, every $4,000 an ounce it goes up, they can deposit $1 trillion into the TGA, scot-free. Imagine if gold goes to 20K, suddenly they can just take that trillions of dollars, either pay for infrastructure, pay off a bunch of the debt, get debt to GDP down. You need an asset to recapitalize the system that its inflation doesn't blow up anything else. So it can't be oil. It can't really be commodities. Bitcoin and gold are the primary candidates that you can inflate, even silver, because it's used in electronics and all this kind of stuff. Like, you probably don't want silver to go too high either because you want these industrial metals to be cheap because that's going to help the world not blow up. You kind of need gold and Bitcoin to go up. So ironically enough, the ECB is not wrong. They do need Bitcoin to impoverish people. It just happens to be that's how you recapitalize the system. That's the game. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. I don't hate it as a Bitcoin holder and small holdings of gold on my finger. But yeah, it's going to get wild. I know I asked you last time, how high?
Everyone wants to know. So I have two answers to this question. First one is the practical one. The second one, I'll just have some fun. So in terms of the practical one, We were talking about unrealized losses before as like bear market creating. Flip that around. What creates an uptrend will break to the downside eventually. What creates that downtrend? Too many people see a fat green number in their portfolio and go, yeah, I'm in. I have to take some, right? So unrealized profit getting really, really high is that level where we start to see people sell. Now, you've got to remember that just because people are selling doesn't mean there's not enough demand to just punch through it. So I use things like, you'll hear MVRV ratio, right? There's various forms of this. It's basically modeling how much unrealized profit is in the system. So as it stands right now, if we get up into like the 120,000, 130,000 realm, that's where we get to a point where hodlers can be expected to start seriously ramping up their sell side, right? So in that 100, 110, 120,000, that's where that real sell side is going to kick in. Now, that doesn't mean demand can't punch through it. It certainly can. But that's where we'll see a lot of metrics saying hodlers are taking some chips off the table here, and eventually that will overwhelm things. So that's a moving target, right? That can continue to climb as demand creeps in, but that's where it stands as of right now. In terms of where I think we're going to go, right, having some fun with this thing, when I play around with these ideas, right, and my old man's got Bitcoin, I have to pare back where I think it's going to go, because otherwise he just thinks I'm insane. I wouldn't be surprised if we got to 250 in the next, 3 years, something in that kind of period. I am certainly in the camp where I think bear markets are not going to be the 80 down. I think a lot of people are going to be expecting that 80 down, and they might get a 50 or a 45 or a 65, and then away it goes again. I don't think we're going to get, again, it depends on all sorts of factors, but I think generally speaking, unless we get GameStop buying at the highs, right? If we get GameStop buying at the highs, maybe a 70, but if we don't, I think that the bears will be more muted. So I think people will lose track of where the top is, right? Where is the cycle? Where did it start? Is that a bear? I don't know. Did we just go through a bear? Maybe, right? So there's all these interesting dynamics. So look, I think 250 is reasonable, right? It's not completely ridiculous. We'll get up into the hundreds. I think I see so many people just talking about this is where it's going to end, like TradFi guys. It makes sense at 100K. It makes sense at 250K. I think the concept of relative value, Bitcoin's about 10% of gold. I think it's about less than that now that gold's run. But if Bitcoin can get to 25% of gold, right, I think you and I would agree that Bitcoin is a superior asset to gold. And, case in point, if you've ever bought physical gold, it is a real pain in the ass. You got to go to a physical place. You got to pick it up. You got to store it in a safe. Like, it's a physical thing. Now, that's great because it's self-custody. But I could also buy Bitcoin and send it to my cold card, and it will take me a fraction of the time. It doesn't even require a bus ticket. Right? You've got all these different dynamics where Bitcoin is just vastly, vastly superior. So can it get to 25% of gold? Of course it can, right? That's kind of obvious. So can it get to 100% of gold? Not anytime soon, but what would 100% parity be? Well, it'd be about 10.8 kilograms of gold per Bitcoin. Right now, it's just under one kilo, right? 30 ounces or something like that. So, that's that long-term view. My price target's actually in gold terms, right? 10.8 kilos, that's my actual number, which is, I think that's like 600,000, 700,000 or something. It's something ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's funny, like the Bitcoin overtaking or reaching parity with gold's market cap has been a meme in Bitcoin for so long, but now with gold running like that,
it's a moving target.
Benchmark is going up way higher. And like, if it goes to 10,000, you got to 5x the benchmark price, which I think right now they're around $2,000 gold. It was what, like $600,000 Bitcoin. And like, if gold runs to $10,000 and stays there for a while, like that's $3 million Bitcoin.
Total. And the other thing I think is actually quite interesting. I've been just observing how markets work. And there's I recently actually bought some platinum. And the only reason I bought platinum is because historically speaking, it trades at a premium to gold. Right now it's at a 65% discount. And I do know that a lot of investors have not ridden this gold wave, right? It's been mostly central banks and people in the East buying gold. So they're only just saying, oh shit, I missed the run on gold. So that's why silver starts to move, because it's like the poor man's gold, right? You're going to buy the cheaper asset. And I just have this very simple thesis. I'm like, well, if platinum's currently trading at $1,000, could it get to 2,700? Probably. That's not a bad little return. So like, and I expect people to go on this like catch-up trade. And in many ways, Bitcoin is that catch-up trade as well, right? Because it's a sound money asset that is still monetizing And really, it tends to follow gold like 6 months, you know, in arrears. So I do think this like catch-up trade thing is a very, very real concept. We see it all the time in the crypto space, right? You get fucking some shitcoin runs. They go, oh, I missed that one. Don't worry, I'll buy the next one down. You get this waterfall effect. We see it in equities as well, right? The big caps run and then you get this rotation down. And I can't help but feel that these catch-up trades are probably going to kind of kick in. So I bought some platinum because I just want to test the theory. I want to put some money on the line, actually test and see whether this happens, right? Get some skin in the game. So I'm kind of invested in the outcome. But I do think Bitcoin is going to sit in that catch-up trade as well, because why is gold running? Okay, once I form a thesis on that, can I apply that to any other assets that haven't already run? Oh, look, there's probably like three or four of them. I'll buy one of those.
Yeah. All right, you heard it here first. James is a now platinum analyst. And Platinum Maxi. James, thank you for your time and your research. Your newsletter, I've been loving your newsletter. If you're interested in shedding the psychological volatility that you will inevitably go through if you hold Bitcoin, I highly recommend reading James's newsletter. You can get that at checkonchain.substack.com.
Checkonchain.com. You'll find it. There's a newsletter sign up.
Yeah. It's incredible stuff. And you're putting out quite a lot of content too.
Yeah, so we do a video and a written post for every single one, because some people like to listen, some people like to read. And the way it works for me, when I write the piece and I develop the charts, so I write the piece, that's where I do my thinking. And that's where I like really consolidate ideas. And then the video is me kind of wrapping the whole thing up. So they're the same thing. Some people read and watch. In fact, we did a survey a little while back. We've got a really like organic distribution. 25% of people read, 25% watch, and 50% do both. So it kind of services all those different angles. But the take we went with is with your Bitcoin personal trainer. And the idea is that, like, you know, the market is, it's like being in a live combat sport, right? You're continually fighting all these different pieces of information and ideas. Should I sell? Should I buy? Am I scared? Am I not? And the idea is just to ground people out and say, well, let's focus on what really matters. Do we care about how people are in profit? Are they taking profits? Like, and just sequentially stepping through, doing the routine. You know, you go to the gym, you do your reps, and you get much better at surviving these things.
And it's going to be increasingly important as volatility increases. So better start early, freaks.
That's it.
James, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you. And I'm sure we'll be catching up at some point as the volatility increases.
100%. Good on you, mate. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Peace and love, freaks.